This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Friday, the 2nd of March. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Brian Fernandez here with me. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, everyone.
Excited for the weekend?
Yes, absolutely.
Once we get over today, shall we say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so this weekend also, we're going to be... We're going to have the Oscars. Well, that's actually technically in the States Sunday night. So that would be Monday morning for us. But you're going to see a lot of Oscar buzz over this weekend, particularly because this is going to be the 90th anniversary of the Academy Awards. And I think it was, for me, it was quite interesting. I was just reading on Twitter that I was wondering why is it called the Oscars when it's the Academy Awards? And apparently, although it's been unconfirmed, there's a popular tale that kind of goes around the origin of the name. Apparently, someone said that the statuette of the Academy Awards looks like one of this person's Uncle Oscar, and they started just calling it Oscar, and that was it.
So it just lasted amazing tradition, isn't
90
it?
Years. Imagine
so
that.
So 1929 in May was the first Oscars.
Exactly.
Incredible.
And hopefully we won't see... Oscars so hashtag Oscars so white trending this weekend. Hopefully we might see an increase in the number of women and minority winners for this year. But that's something to keep an eye out on Monday morning or Sunday night technically in the US. But also breaking news overnight. We had US President Donald Trump saying that he will sign off on steep tariffs on steel and aluminium imports next week, and this will hit producers like Canada and China. So he's saying that steel products face a 25% tariff with 10% on aluminium goods.
Yeah, so Melissa, the US apparently imports four times more steel than it exports, and it's very reliant on steel from across the globe. Just about 100 nations literally supply the US with steel.
I'm not surprised that if this news will provoke an angry reaction from China and, I don't know, maybe spark a new trade war between the two countries. A quick look at Catalonia. The fugitive Catalan separatist leader Carles Puigdemont has said that he is ending his bid to be reappointed president of Spain's northeastern region. Now he's stepping aside in favor of detained activist Jordi Sanchez. Puigdemont, I think right now is in Belgium. He's on self-imposed exile there and has been told by the Spanish government, the Spanish federal government, that if he does return to the country, he will be arrested.
Yeah, so Jordi Sanchez and several other Catalan pro-independence politicians have also been are still imprisoned in connection with the poll. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see moving forward how this whole story plays out in terms of the independence movement.
Well, since we're looking at Europe, an interesting story caught my attention this morning. An Austrian court has said citizens have the right to swear or make obscene gestures at their politicians. And this comes following a complaint by a far-right politician, Heinz Christian Strache, I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly, head of the right-wing Freedom Party, has argued that the far-left activists has made public insults by criticizing him in a video. So apparently these far-left group has actually asked its supporters to raise their middle finger to express their distaste with the right-wing group.
Yeah, so the Vienna court dismissed his complaint and said that the right to provocative and shocking political opinion was a fundamental part of the freedom of expression.
I love that. I love that. They're telling the politicians to grow a thick skin. If you get into politics, that's what you're going to have to deal with. It's coming up to 5 minutes past six. After this, we're going to tell you why New Zealand is releasing a rabbit-killing virus next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. This is the morning run, and I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Brian Fernandez here with me. You just heard Pile Driver Waltz by Alex Turner, the Arctic Monkeys front man. And we're looking at New Zealand this morning. Why because they're planning to release a rabbit virus across the country in an attempt to cull the ballooning wild population there. So wild rabbits are seen as a pest in New Zealand, and now that the government is thinking about releasing this rabbit virus, farming groups have welcomed the move. However, I don't think it will sit well with the animal rights activists.
Yeah, so essentially, why are they doing this? Because rabbits have created a lot of problems for farmers in New Zealand. Basically, they compete with livestock for pasture and cause damage for burrowing. And apparently cost about 50 million New Zealand dollars in lost production every year. But Melissa, you know, at the end of the day, when we upset the delicate balance in terms of an ecosystem, you really set the stage. I mean, today we don't know enough about animals and biodiversity and ecosystems.
When you say disrupt the delicate balance of the ecosystem, you mean by introducing this virus?
Yeah, because what happens is you're going to kill off the rabbits, right? Mm. So it's going to impact the rabbit population. But how is that then going to impact the overall ecosystem?
Well, I do believe that they looked at this virus, this particular strain, only affects rabbits. It's called the rabbit hemorrhagic. I can't remember pronounce the word. It's a strain that is very effective, but will only target rabbits. I do have to take the point though, Brian, that humans cause this problem. So when you say, you know, we should be careful about disrupting the balance of the ecosystem, we've already done that by encroaching on wildlife's space. So a human population by itself already, you know, human-wildlife conflict arises from human activity. So we, I guess, caused this problem to begin with. And if you go back even further, New Zealand and Australia started it by introducing a rabbit population. These are countries where rabbits were not native. And that I think, it started there. Mm-hmm. There's also a problem of why animal overpopulation happens, and it's because of a lack of prey. So in the wild, animal population will be kept in balance through predator-prey relationship. But the reason is that we have come and settled on this land, humans I mean, and removed the natural prey of rabbits. So is it then our job to then recreate some kind of balance in the ecosystem?
Yeah, that's a fair point as well. Of course, they also raise ethical issues of actually why are we basically killing all these animals that we've are growing freely at this point of time. Yes, it causes some damage to farmers and so forth, but overall, should we really kill the animals?
The danger of that is then you would have an island overrun by rabbits in New Zealand. So I think that there could be a reason. So I don't think that New Zealand is attempting this willy-nilly. I think that it has come to a point where they believe something must be done. And the most humane way, in their opinion, is to introduce a virus that only targets specific types of rabbits. I do think New Zealand's track record when it comes to their ecological report card seems to be better than most other countries. So I guess they must have put some thought into this.
I agree with you on that, because agriculture is a big part of their economy.
Sure.
So they've been very, just like Australia, they're very, very careful in terms of what you can bring into the country and controlling anything to do with animals and livestock and so forth. So I would think, you know, I see your point of view, that they would probably have thought this through very, very well.
It's coming up to 6:13, and after this, we're going to be looking at a survey that finds that Malaysians are among the world's most vacation-deprived people. We'll tell you more after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Adris with Brian Fernandez. 6:18 right now. You just heard Kokomo with the Beach Boys. And, you know, the thing they mentioned about six vacation spots in that movie. Aruba, Jamaica, Bermuda, Bahama. Come on, Pretty Mama. If you want all those, you want to go to vacation to all those spots, you might want to consider the findings of this next survey by Expedia.com.my, an online travel portal. Apparently, Malaysians are the third most vacation-deprived population globally. And within Asia Pacific, we're ranked second. This is according to Expedia's 17th annual survey on vacation deprivation. They found that almost two-thirds of Malaysians surveyed revealed that they felt that they were very or somewhat vacation deprived.
But, you know, Melissa, the interesting thing when I read this article was, how do they measure vacation deprivation? Is it based on leave not taken, or is it based on amount of time not traveled? Or, you know, how do they measure that?
Well, I think it's a perception. So they asked 15,000 full-time working adults in 30 markets. And I believe they asked, whether or not Malaysians would take a vacation to go on leave. Apparently, it turns out that some of the reasons why, for this kind of vacation deprivation was budget or affordability issues. The desire to save up for vacation days, save up vacation days for perhaps longer holidays, and the inability to get away from work. However, we have to remember, consider the source. This is coming from Expedia, right?
Yeah, it's very self-serving.
It is. So if they say, Malaysians, you are vacation deprived, why don't you take a holiday and consider Expedia?
But if you look at those numbers in that article, you would see that France, in fact, is also one of the countries that where the population thinks they are vacation deprived. And that's not a traditional source that you would think. France is a country that seems to have a lot of leisure and they have a very short working week.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite subjective, I suppose, who you ask and the sort of answers that you'll get.
One of the things also that came to me when I was kind of going through the findings of this survey is the word deprived. It makes it seem that vacation is a right, not a privilege. And I don't know when we made that kind of mental switch. I used, when I was growing up, vacations were such a privilege. It wasn't an assumption that we would be going on vacation that year. And it was something that we looked forward to, we scrimped and saved. And when it finally happened, it was a huge event. I wouldn't say, it wasn't every year that we went on holidays, locally or overseas. And now I feel if you don't go for vacation in 1 year, you don't go for an overseas holiday in 1 year, most people consider that deprivation.
I think your experience is similar to mine. I think it was really a privilege for us to go on holidays. Mm. A lot of times, especially when we were much younger, it was just cuti Malaysia.
Yeah.
And then obviously, as we got a little bit older and maybe our incomes went up a little bit, my parents were able to take us overseas. But today, you're right, a lot of people, it's almost a birthright. They expect to go on holidays every year.
Mm, it's not like the right to food or right to education.
Absolutely.
Right to vacation doesn't happen.
But I think, Melissa, it's also to do with peer pressure. Because of social media, everyone's looking at their friends and they're traveling and they're going to Japan or Niseko for skiing or to the UK and so forth. So there's an element of peer pressure. And so unfortunately, what happens then is people put aside those traditional elements of, I need to save for a vacation, and then tell themselves, well, I need a vacation and I want a vacation. It's not a...
I deserve
a vacation,
yes.
And let's put it on the credit card.
Well, but also I think the advent of low-cost travel has done a lot to, I guess, encourage people to travel, any long weekend, to pack up and go somewhere, because it's suddenly become a lot cheaper and a lot more accessible to people. So I think because of that, and plus the social media element, as you mentioned, Brian, because of that, more and more people, myself included sometimes, feel that, haven't gone anywhere in a while. Shall we do something this long weekend or the next long weekend?
And Melissa, the cost element is also very, very crucial, because if you take a holiday if you fly from KL to Langkawi, Langkawi is not the cheapest local destination. In fact, I think you can probably fly to Phuket and have a holiday in Phuket and it'll probably be cheaper.
Well, we would love to hear what you think about this survey. Are we really that vacation deprived? And what we've done is we've put out a Twitter poll to ask you if you think that vacations are a privilege or a right? Why don't you weigh in and tell us what you think? Almost 90% of the people who've weighed in this morning or who've weighed in this morning believe it's a privilege. Only 10% believe that it's a right. So we'd love to hear what you think. Or you can share more of your thoughts on WhatsApp. 018-789-8899 is our number. Or tweet us at BFM Radio. 6:23 right now, and we've got the first news bulletin coming up shortly. But to take you there, Neutral Milk Hotel with In the Aeroplane Over the Sea. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. 6:40 on the clock. You're listening to The Morning Run. Friday, the 2nd of March. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez. Now, that you just heard the Black Keys with Tighten Up. And that's something that Singaporean ministers will have to do soon, because it turns out that they're not going to get a raise anytime soon. The Singapore Parliament yesterday heard that the government isn't accepting the 9% salary increase recommended by a review committee. So after the last review, Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's annual income fell 36% to $2.2 million. New ministers now make about $1.1 million, just down from the $1.6 million they made in 2011.
Yeah, so the review in 2011 was really because they cut salaries after voter unhappiness over a widening income gap kind of weakened support for the ruling party in the election. So one of the things after that was really that they reduced the salaries. But Singapore has always maintained that the million-dollar ministerial salaries essentially prevented corruption and helped to attract and retain talent. So the idea behind it is they would be able to widen the gene pool and attract people from outside the civil service and the military, where people traditionally came from that served as ministers.
Like come to civil service, can be a politician, and you can earn, you can be a millionaire. You could earn $1 million bucks per month or per year. So this is quite interesting because, so yes, that the idea that, okay, so by paying the minister's top dollar, you will prevent corruption, you will attract talent. And now they're saying, okay, no salary increase for you because it has to reflect the sentiment on the ground. The sentiment on the ground is a feeling of unhappiness, not just during the elections, as you mentioned, Brian, in 2011, but also recently with the kind of the budget, the, you know, announcing that GST is going to be increased. So I think there's a feeling that, okay, times are tough, the cost of living is increasing in Singapore. And to reflect this kind of tightening of the belt, ministers must do that too. And I think that's really good. They've got a finger on the pulse of the sentiment.
Yeah, because Melissa, I think this is a result of them I think of mistakes in the past where they didn't read the signals on the ground as effectively. Mm. I think, you know, they really have their pulse on the ground right now.
So the question is, do the Malaysian ministers have their finger on the pulse on the ground? If you look at how Malaysian ministers make... So just to put into context, the Singapore... So Singapore's ministers have one of the highest salaries in the world, if I'm not mistaken. They have, I think, the US has half their salaries. So looking at the US, by comparison, cabinet ministers in the US typically earn a quarter of what Singapore ministers get. So this is quite interesting. Malaysian ministers, I think, earn a lot less than our neighbours down south.
Yeah, apparently our members of parliament, for example, are one of the lowest paid in Southeast Asia. And prior to the amendments of the Members of Parliament Act in 2015, members of parliament were only paid 4,112 ringgit per month.
That was before.
That was before.
Right now, they earn about 16,000.
Okay. That's right.
That's 16,000 a month, excluding allowances, and that's for every MP in Malaysia. Senators earn about 11,000 a month. This is ringgit, and they can claim for entertainment allowance up to 2,500 ringgit. They can claim fuel allowance up to 1,005, and also toll allowance for up to 300. But also, every time they go to a parliament sitting, they get 200 ringgit a day. And they get an allowance of 150 ringgit a day whenever they attend meetings with government agencies.
Yeah, so one of the things that surprised me, which I didn't know was that when you become a minister, you actually get the benefit of your MP salary.
A cabinet minister.
Yeah, cabinet minister, as well as your full cabinet minister salary. So when you add both of them up, your annual compensation should be something in the region of 370,000 ringgit, which is really not bad. It's something that I feel that they should be paid. They run the government. They should be capable.
Should they be paid more to perhaps combat corruption the way that Singapore is doing it?
Perhaps a little bit more. I'm a believer in cost of living increases, like everyone else. I think it should be the same as the rest of the population. But I think the Singapore example is probably an extreme example. I wouldn't want us to take that direction.
Tell us what you think. Do you think that ministers in Malaysia should follow what our neighbours down south are doing in terms of getting a pay hike moratorium? WhatsApp number 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Coming up, the Home Ministry claims that there are many reports on human trafficking that are false. So we're going to be hearing some thoughts from Glorine Das, Executive Director of Tenaga Nita. So stay tuned. BFM 89. BFM 89.9. Never Can Say Goodbye by the Jackson 5. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. Melissa and Brian here with you. It's coming up to 6:50 right now. And the Home Ministry has revealed that many reports on human trafficking by international or local media that are spread on social media are simply not true.
The ministry found that most of them were false reports after conducting investigations when they receive such reports.
Yeah, so what we did was we spoke to Glorine Das, the executive director of Tenaga Nita. Tenaga Nita, of course, is known for the work that they do in championing the rights of foreign migrants. We really wanted to know what she thought about this story. And so we asked her if she had come across any reports on human trafficking which are false or dubious, either in the news or on social media.
In the course of Tenaga Nita's work on human trafficking cases, we do not usually just take on cases that is reported on news portal and social media. In fact, what we do is our own fact-finding and analysis on the cases reported on this platform before an intervention is made. And at all times, the news reported as substance and enough evidence to constitute human trafficking. In fact, the media whom we work with, who report the news, have shown a tremendous amount of professionalism in the way the news is reported, and they are backed up with facts and evidence. There may be some news that may come through as a topic to be sensationalized by the media, and our experiences have been that the news reported may not have full information, but it is certainly not fake or dubious.
The nature of human trafficking cases is such that it could become very difficult to verify. So we asked Glorine if this could be the reason why the authorities won't consider some cases to be human trafficking.
I think it all boils down to education and knowledge of what constitutes human trafficking. If there is a lack of understanding, then of course it is hard to investigate and verify. This is because human trafficking is complex in its nature. It goes beyond the crimes such as buying and selling of human beings for sex, labor, or organs. It also needs to review the slave-like practices of work which the victims perform, including the dynamics between the victims and their perpetrators, which essentially holds them in a debt bondage, which qualifies the situation of human trafficking. Now, when there is no education or the right knowledge on human trafficking, the screening procedures within authorities and agencies become ineffective because most of them who are affected are not identified as victims of human trafficking. Therefore, the perpetrators are charged under different laws such as Employment Act or Penal Code, with victims also being further criminalized under Immigration Act for their undocumented status. On another point, there is also the potential risk involved in victims coming forward to give testimonies and statements because there is a lack of protection in the overall system. Now, this may seem like a difficult element to investigate and to verify, but with education and knowledge, we can do it.
That was Glorine Das, Executive Director of Tanaga Nita, an NGO that looks at protecting the rights of foreign migrants. Now, I thought that was really quite interesting, Brian, the things that she said. You know, she made a good point that sometimes most of these cases are backed by evidence, are backed by kind of solid witness testimony, but the topic often becomes sensationalized, and I think sometimes that can be mistaken as dubious or a fake or false.
The other thing that she also brought up that was very interesting, Melissa, is the definition of human trafficking. So the fact that, for example, many foreign workers come to Malaysia, they're almost indentured workers because they borrow heavily and to come to Malaysia, and they literally have to work off the debt. Quotes as such. So essentially, that's a form of human trafficking as well, which a lot of us are not very aware of.
I'm kind of concerned about what the Home Ministry is saying, because, you know, by saying that, or by deeming a lot of these reports as not true or false or fake, it could deter others from wanting to report. And, they've also come up in a statement saying that, okay, well, members of the public with information about human trafficking should either lodge a report with the ministry, you can call up or you can come in. But as Glorine pointed out earlier, sometimes there's a lack of protection for the informants. And if the minister or ministries already with the perception that, you know, this could be false, it doesn't help. You know.
Exactly. And also the fact that because there's so much money involved in this sort of human trafficking type businesses, if someone actually came forward, they would be under serious threat of danger.
Coming up to 6:55, we've got the 7 o'clock news bulletin at the top of the hour. And Lenny Kravitz now with Are You Gonna Go My Way on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. If you've just joined us, welcome. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez. It's coming up to 7 minutes past 7 o'clock on Friday, the 2nd of March. And in this hour, we're going to be taking a look at the papers, the front pages of the papers. The NST has Malaysia launching a national human rights plan yesterday. And if we take a look at the business pages, Air Asia mostly covers most of the business news headlines this morning. They're divesting a leasing business for over $1 billion. We'll give you the details shortly. But I also want to address a WhatsApp that we got from Robert, and he was weighing in on our discussion, Brian, earlier about Singaporean ministers not getting a raise in their salaries this year. Robert says that since we're benchmarking with Singapore, we should measure the number of ministers against or servicing the population. And as well as the government servants, and these ministers get government servants to do the work. So I think that's something Robert is saying, well, maybe we should look at the productivity or the output to measure the salary. All right. Thank you, Robert, for your WhatsApp. And if you want to join the conversation, you can at any point in time this morning. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. And our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. But now let's take a look at the... Let's take a look into a policy paper that is questioning the impact of BRIM. Because yesterday on The Breakfast Grill, I spoke to the authors of the UNICEF report on urban child poverty and deprivation, specifically in low-cost flats in KL. And one of the more interesting findings of that report was that while all these households that they surveyed in low-cost flats in KL should qualify for BRIM, only 68% actually receive it.
Yes, here's another revelation about BRIM. Up to one-third of the urban poor populations polled by the study admitted they had no knowledge about BRIM, or they were not eligible, or knowledge of whether or not they were eligible to apply. So although the cash distribution program has been widely publicised, various issues with the rollout and outreach have been reported.
Yeah, so Wan Ya Shin, social policy researcher with IDEAS, or the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs as a think tank, spoke to us about some of the problems that BRIM has at the moment.
Okay, First thing, the problem of BRIM is that it's a one-off thing, it's a cash handout. There is also no such thing as to create support after that for the people to exit from poverty in that sense. So that's one of the biggest problems, which it creates dependency, because it doesn't help the people to improve their skills or to have a long-term and sustainable solution to that. And the second thing is the constraint of that limited amount of money. How much can that money help in tackling the cost of rise of cost of living? If we look at BRIM, it's just a few hundred ringgit. It's not going to do a lot in terms of tackling poverty per se. It's just more to help for short term. So in the long term, it's not going to do much in tackling the issue of poverty.
We have so many programs and initiatives that are quite similar to BRIM. And so we asked Yashin if she thought that this was a problem.
So the thing is, there is no coordination and monitoring of all these different cash aids. So on top of BRIM, there's also others. So whether you get access to them or not, it depends on whether you know about this program. So when there's so many ministries and agencies that are doing different programs, it's hard for the people to know where to access all this when they need that money. So that's one part of the problem of cash aid. Then there needs to be more coordination within the agency and something more like an umbrella that's overlooking all the programs that is in the country. And also to reduce duplication, because while a certain recipient of one particular program might be a recipient of another, just to reduce duplication and to ensure that people who really need it get the money.
Here's Yashin's overall verdict on the BRIM policy.
I would say that it is a good policy to tackle short-term insufficiency for the people, but we have to look at more long-term policies. When we talk about BRIM, mostly it's because we want to tackle the rise of cost of living. So why are the people not having enough? So we come back to more inherent questions of wages. So is the wages increasing according to the productivity of the nation? So that is more relevant than just giving a cash handout every time it's not enough for the people to survive. So looking at the wages will be something more substantial and more long-term. Make sure that the wages is substantial, you know. That will be a better policy. And the second thing is that what are the schemes to help the people to improve their skills? For example, to promote entrepreneurship or improve their skills to have better income. Yeah, I think that is more sustainable policies.
And finally, we asked Yashin why our wages aren't rising in tandem with the rising cost of living.
I think one of the most important things is there's a lack of labor union within the country. There's a decreasing number of labor unions within the country. So when there's no voice for the workers, wages will tend to rise slower than it should be. So usually in nation, productivity and wages grow hand in hand. But for Malaysia, it's not really the case.
That was Wan Yashin, social policy researcher at the think tank Ideas. What do you think, Brian? Do you think that you agree with Yashin that perhaps BRIM, there are, I guess, inefficiencies when it comes to BRIM?
I think one of the things is she brought up a very good point about different agencies having different policies.
Duplicates, right?
Yeah. And so one of the things to overcome that is perhaps, she says, a centralized agency. That seems to be like adding more bureaucracy. Perhaps maybe something a little bit simpler, like, for example, a website that actually consolidates that information. That could perhaps be a way that, and that how the government then markets this is basically by one URL and say, this is a central point. If you are potentially below the poverty line or you need assistance, this is the URL you go to. And essentially that pulls information from everywhere else.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you're that's kind of catering to a tech-savvy crowd. One of the things that Dr. Muhammad Khalid said on The Breakfast Grill yesterday was really people don't know how to get BRIM. They don't know how to go about applying for BRIM or where to get it or where to ask for it. And these are not people in Guamusang or Temelo. These are people in the heart of KL, and they don't know how to do it. So I don't know whether a website will solve the problem.
So the website or something like that is really the first step. The second step is really the marketing of it. So really, when you have one point or focus or one focal point, essentially then any relevant agency then does outreach programs to these to the target audiences, really to try to get them to understand and educate them that these are available.
Yeah, I have to say, I think BRIM has multiple issues here in terms of, you know, it's not just its perception, because it does have a negative perception, but also in terms of its implementation, right? Most social assistance policies, we can give maybe a 10 to 20% allowance for leakages, but a 68% allowance when it comes to low-cost housing is unacceptable. You know, these are the households that need BRIM the most, but they're not getting it. So,
and it's in our backyard. That's what I was very surprised when I heard that.
Yeah, so I think there are issues when it comes to the rollout of this program. And yeah, I'm glad that there's a national conversation now talking about the effectiveness of BRIM. All right, it's coming up to 7:15, and we're going to be taking a look at the morning papers after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.